Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, May 10th, 2011, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-host, Sierra. Lavendar might not be able to join us tonight, but she will be back next week. We are so pleased to have Richard Dolan with us again this evening. His latest book, called AD, After Disclosure, The People's Guide to Life After Contact, co-authored with Bryce Zabel, is a must-read for Starseed, since being well-prepared for disclosure is a mission we all share. Richard is considered by many to be the world's foremost historian on UFOs, and his writing is widely seen as the gold standard on the subject. Tonight he'll also be talking about his recent article, Breakaway Civilization, which can be found on both his websites, which are www.keyholepublishing.com and www.afterdisclosure.com. And both of those websites I have posted in the comment section on our main show page. We had the pleasure of meeting Richard at the Wake Up Now conference, where he gave a fascinating presentation on his work and also spent some quality time with our Starseed group. We'd like to thank Purple Sage for handling the switchboard and the chat room this evening, and we would appreciate your chat being on topic. Purple Sage will be forwarding your questions to us from the chat room for those who can't call in. And if you can call, our number is 917-889-8292. That's 917-889-8292. Then press 1 so we know you have something to say. You can also listen on your computer at blogtalkradio.com/starseed-radio-academy. As always, we ask you to be brief, and tonight, please, only questions or comments on Mr. Dolan's topics. Before we get started, I'd like to ask each and every one of you for your help. As I do every week, I want you to know we get a lot of wonderful emails from our listeners and members of our community wanting to know what they can do to help us. As you know, our motto is empowering Starseed to better serve the planet. And one of the best ways we can do that is to increase our visibility. Last week, we had almost 1,500 people listening to our show, but so far, only 265 have registered at Blog Talk Radio and clicked the word follow on our show page. If we could really increase our number of official followers, we'll have a better chance of increasing our visibility and being a featured show here. So please register for free and click the word follow on our show page. The Starseed Radio Academy team is grateful for your help. If you haven't visited our main site yet, which is starseedhotline.com, we have a lot of vital information for Starseed in our Vault of Knowledge. The entire site is coded for Starseed activation. We also have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. That's starseedhotline.ning.com. Plus, we're on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go. And yes, I'm still working on adding photos for all of our archive shows with the new format here at Blog Talk. So we don't have to keep seeing that gigantic headshot of me every time. So we'll get started with Sierra and Richard in just a moment. But first, I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. We also want you to know that we have so many requests for our Starseed confirmation service, which we call a Stage 1 reading, that there could be up to a two-week wait, and since being away at the conference, we'll be trying hard to get caught up. With a Stage 1 reading, you'll get your natal and progress charts and an MP3 of your reading, pointing out and explaining your star markings if you have them. Our Stage 2 readings, which are a one-on-one phone consultation, do get priority and include the Starseed confirmation. Both Lavendar and I are available for Starseed confirmation and personal consultation. Don't forget, if you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by requesting your solar return timing. Your manifestational ability is amplified 1,000-fold during those 10 hours, so don't miss it. And now I'd like to introduce my co-host for tonight, Sierra. Hello, Sierra. Hello. Sorry, I had your mic got muted again. So, and now my co-host, Sierra.
Hi. It's great to be here with you all. Thank you.
Great. Now, we have Richard Dolan with us, so do you want to just get right to him?
Absolutely. Hello,
okay.
Richard.
Let me get that mic. Okay, your mic is open. You're on the air, Richard. Welcome.
Hello, Ariel, and hello, Sierra. It's great to be on once again on this wonderful show. And I would just like to mention that I had such a great time meeting you, Ariel, meeting Lavendar, and meeting you, Sierra, just the other week in Albuquerque. And there are some other great folks with Starseed Hotline that were there. And I had such a great time. We had a nice dinner out on the final night of that conference. It was a very memorable evening for so many reasons, but mostly just for the great company.
Thank you.
Oh, it was really great meeting you also, Richard, and spending time with you and getting to know you as a person as well as a, you know, just a fabulous author. So
thanks.
It's just really great. Well, I wanted to go ahead and start off. I received an email a couple days ago from Ariel, and it was talking about the NSA release that happened to the public. And I just want to talk about that a little bit and bring the listeners up to speed on what it is I'm talking about, and then I'd love to have your comments on it. So basically, October 21st of 2004, the NSA approved, that's the National Security Agency, approved a release of a public portion of a journal titled Extraterrestrial Signals. And they only released it on April 21st, 2011. They were stonewalling the release of this hundreds of other NSA documents until Peter Gersten, a lawyer from Arizona, won a lawsuit that he brought against the NSA. Now,
right.
What was released, yeah, it really took something, right, to go ahead and
right.
have
that's
to do what
right.
they were going to do. what was released was just basically a partial document written by the top cryptologist of the world, who is Dr. Campaign, or I believe that's how you spell or pronounce his name, but it's Campaigne, who was worked
that's
with
right.
Needle Security. Do you know if that's how you pronounce his name, Richard?
I'm pulling it up right now. I think you're close enough. You're good.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he has worked with Dr. Campaign has worked with the Naval Security Group, the Army Security Agency, and the National Security Agency. And he was to decode 29 different messages from outer space picked up by the Sputnik satellite. So if the listeners are interested in going and seeing this particular article, it was actually written up by another radio host that put this particular piece out. But you would go to www.nsa.gov/public-info/underscore-files/UFO/key _2_ET_messages.pdf. Now, this is actually from the NSA website itself. So that's where you would want to go if you want to just look at what we're talking about. But
yeah, I think that link is a little bit off the way you described it, Sarah, because I was just typing it in as you mentioned it. That does take you to the NSA website, however. And but you get an error notice, at least as I followed it up. So you had there's not supposed to be an underscore before the word files. Let me just double check that. Now, we'll find it. We'll get the exact link.
Yeah, and we will post it in the comments so that you can go look at it after the show, because that's a long address.
It sure
yeah,
is.
Exactly. They have it's nsagov/public_info/dclass/UFO and then /index. SHTML, and that'll get you to a lot of the NSA, and the bottom one here, there's 42 documents that they have listed there, and the final two are by the Howard Campagna, I think you would probably pronounce it. Key to the Extraterrestrial Messages is number 41, and that's the one that's gotten all of this attention in the last few weeks. And it is a very interesting document, without a doubt. There are really a couple of ways, if I can just give my own take on what this is about. This is from the early 1960s. This document is from, I'm not sure if it's dated. It's from many decades ago. And this gentleman is talking about an NSA program to study signals that are from outer space, ET signals. Now, the one thing about it that, because I've been following this on a number of threads and discussing this with a number of other researchers, and the thing that we seem to come down to is it's one of two things. They either got an actual extraterrestrial signal, or it was part of a program within NSA to prepare if they were to receive extraterrestrial signals as a kind of test, I suppose. I'm not sure if there was a whole lot of agreement that this was absolute confirmation that they received, a signal from elsewhere. So that would be the one qualification I would mention to this. But it's an absolutely fascinating document. At the very least, it shows that NSA is taking very seriously the likelihood that they would be picking up signals from elsewhere, and then, you know, what would they do about it in the event that they did pick up a signal.
Now, when I was reading through that particular document early, Richard, it was talking about the actual message, whatever that message came from, and the way that it was put together, and how they translated the codes and stuff like that. It was sent in sort of a binary code. And this Dr. Campagna was going through and saying that as he's gotten through to the end of it, that he's found a couple mistakes, and actually they did short translations, like into or belongs to or end of transmission or and stuff like that, which was interesting. What's frustrating about the whole thing, of course, is they didn't actually put out what the particular message was, just how it was decoded, which was sort of like a bait switch type of a thing.
Well, that's right. I mean, exactly. They don't get to any of that. It's absolutely fascinating, but I'm not sure that the story really the article deals with the NSA actually receiving ET signals. The impression that I received is that they were practicing decoding hypothetical signals from extraterrestrials. Now, one of the things that's worth mentioning is that there is a specialist that was referred to in document number 42, Lambros Kalamahos, who is a cryptologist specialist at the NSA, who's an absolute genius, legend in his time. And he was really interested in UFOs and ET, and had written another paper that argued that they should be taken much more seriously in the official government realm. So there's a lot there, but I'm not 100% sure that this NSA document actually can be considered as proof that they had gotten an ET signal, that they were deciphering it. I've just, not read any. I mean, my reading of it is that it could very well be hypothetical, and this is the interpretation that a number of other people have had of it. So it's interesting, but I would just caution people not to get ahead of the game here and assume that this is proof that the NSA has obtained ET signals. My own take on it.
Okay, great. I was just interested in what your take was, because I know that you've come across a lot of different documents, and your time as a researcher and was wondering if maybe you might would like to talk about that now, some of the documents you've come across or anything that has to do with the FBI you had mentioned at one point when we were speaking.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there's, I mean, one thing that I always try to impress on people is that there's a great wealth of really fascinating documentation relating to the UFO topic that has been pried out, and that's almost the best word, pried out of the government files. Keep in mind that during the early Cold War, the 1940s and 50s, and through most of the 1960s, when a government document was classified, no matter what the classification level was, there was very little expectation ever that these documents would ever see the light of day outside that classified world. One really gets the sense that the people who created these documents, thought that they would remain secret forever. But what happened was that in the mid-60s and then again in the 70s, we passed the Freedom of Information Act. It was first passed in 1966 under President Johnson. It was kind of weak at the time. It really was mostly relevant back then for getting personal information relevant to you from the government. In the mid-70s, in the aftermath of Watergate and Vietnam, the Freedom of Information Act was given some real teeth from a public policy point of view. And from that point, researchers began to be able to petition the government for all kinds of previously classified documents relating to public policy and including UFOs. In fact, that was the thing that shocked the government administrators who were responsible for FOIA was how many UFO requests they got. That dwarfed all other Freedom of Information Act requests, as it does to this day. People ask more about UFOs than any other topic, by far. It's not even close. And during the late 1970s, really under Jimmy Carter's presidency, we received the lion's share of all the documents that we even have today to prove U.S. government interest in UFOs. More than 50% of all of the thousands of documents we got came during the Jimmy Carter years. It's amazing when you think about it. Because after Carter, under Reagan, the Freedom of Information Act was modified to be a lot less user-friendly, a lot less public-friendly, and with a much greater emphasis on keeping secrets. But during the late 70s, we had a real boon in terms of getting many of these formerly classified documents out in the public domain. And once they're out, I mean they're out. There's really nothing you can do about it. And so during that amazing period, we didn't, you know, get every single document that we wanted. Obviously, there was an awful lot that we did not get. But it has to be said that there were some really just extraordinary documents that were released that proved not necessarily that UFOs were ET, but it did prove, if you look at them collectively, that there was something very, very important going on that, in fact, you know, the government had been not denying it all these years. But guess what? They were proven to be lying because we got an amazing cache of documents that are just extraordinary. Some of them just are mind-boggling. For example, one of my favorites is a memo that was sent to the director of the CIA by his chief of scientific intelligence, a man named H. Marshall Chadwell, writing to the director of the CIA, Walter Bedell Smith. And, I mean, listen to this. This is from late 1952, Sierra, and the chief of scientific intelligence for CIA writes, recent reports reaching CIA, let me jump ahead here. At this time, the reports of incidents convince us that there is something going on that must have immediate attention. Sightings of unexplained objects at great altitudes and traveling at high speeds in the vicinity of major U.S. defense installations are of such nature that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles. It's a very straightforward statement, and maybe in the language of the intelligence community's bureaucracy, that's not a big deal.
Right.
But to those of us on the outside of that world, we read that and we think, say what? And
yeah,
certainly, it, right, if this had gotten out at the time, 1952, 1953, you have to assume people would have, you know, really gotten hold of that and said, hey, you got some explaining to do here. But, of course, that was classified for many, many years. And but it's now in the public domain. And that and many, many other descriptions of just amazing events. Here's one I'm just pulling up almost at random from 1951 from New Jersey, Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. A detailed a three-page teletype relating to an attempted jet interception. It's oh my god, it's almost too long to read. Target appeared to approximately follow the coastline, changing its range, then changing its azimuth rapidly, its altitude. Radar tracked it, visual returns, attempted intercepts failed, and on and on and on. And there's just so many of these.
That's amazing. How do I have a question for you, Richard? How do they come out when they're released? You know, in quotations, released. Does that mean that it's just open for people, anybody to come and get access? And then how does a person go about doing that now?
Right. Well, when you're getting these types of documents, you have to go to the specific archive where they're found. And there's many of them. You have in the United States, the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. That is that's a massive repository of government documents. And you can't just walk into these places. You have to prepare ahead of time by really you want to contact one of the key archivists there and tell them what records group and files and folders you're looking for, because they need, you keep in mind, this is not like a regular library. This is absolutely enormous. You can't just start going through the stacks, as it were, like in a regular library, because things go missing. So it's very important that they maintain control over the documents. So you can go to the website and you see like what records group and files within those contain what type of information, generally speaking. They don't tell you all of the details.
Mm-hmm.
And so beforehand, you look at what you think is interesting, and then you make a little checklist. And by the time you go there, if you've done your homework right, you can have all of that stuff ready for you. Or you can have that all laid out when you walk in there and say, I need this, 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 and this. And then you wait, and then they bring it out. They wheel out card after card, and you have to go through it. And you just, if you're lucky, you find something. And you can do that with any of the presidential archives as well. So all of the presidential administrations now, they have an archive. You can go to the Bill Clinton Library, which is now available, all the way back through the Ronald Reagan Library, George Bush. Over time, these collections become available. That doesn't mean you're going to find UFO documents in them, but you have to look. Then you can just write to these agencies, filing a Freedom of Information Act request for any documents pertaining to such and such a topic. That was a very popular tactic back in the 70s and early 80s until it became really expensive. So that was the problem. It was relatively affordable during the Carter years, and it became very expensive during the Reagan years and beyond. And so really what researchers now do is they just go into the archives themselves often and hunt through the stacks, and it takes time.
So the people, all these documents that you find on the Internet, these people have gone through this process, taken their time to go through this process, whether they mailed it in or whether they showed it physically.
That's
right. And then they got a copy of this, and then they posted it online.
That's correct. And most of the documents, as I mentioned, were actually released in the 1970s, before there was an internet. But they were available in, whether private collections, or many of them were published in various books and so forth. So we knew about a lot of the documents, and then when they were published on the internet, it made it easier for everyone to access them.
What do
you find? There's a good repository, in other words, of proven U.S. government documents that I think people, you know, it's important for us to have access to those. There are, of course, other documents that have leaked, allegedly leaked, and these have been debated ever since. You know, are they legitimate or are they disinformation? Popularly, we call them the MJ-12 documents, and there's a lot of those. You have the original leaked documents that came out in the mid-1980s to a couple of UFO researchers. And then during the 1990s and into the 21st century, we've had other leaked documents as well, which collectively we tend to call them the Majestic documents. And you can find most of these on the website of Ryan and Bob Wood. I think it's majesticdocuments.com. It's a great site. But the thing is, these documents are not, like, they're the bastard children of the government. No one claims them. No government agency has said, oh, yeah, they're legitimate. They come from us. But they look, to many of us, they look like legitimate documents that were just leaked out.
Gotcha. And then do we know what the source of that leak was, or is just that's a part of the speculation?
Well, there's, you know, some of them have a very definite source. There's a fellow named Tim Cooper who lives out in California. He was the son of, prominent military intelligence individual. A lot of this information is on the website of majesticdocuments.com. I would encourage people to go look into it. I've studied many of those documents myself, and my own opinion is that a lot of them do look legitimate to me. I think they are legitimate. Ryan and Bob Wood, who I think are very responsible researchers, have spent a lot of time analyzing these. These aren't cases where you just simply have the negative to study. They've got the actual paper in many cases. You can subject these documents to a very intensive, detailed kind of analysis. And they're very upfront about the types of analyses they've done with many of these documents that have come to them. You study the language, you study the concepts that are involved, the paper, the typeface, I mean, all of these things. And I think a lot of these do pass the test of legitimacy. The only thing they have going against them is that official channels of government refuse to acknowledge them as real.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Can I make a request? Can I make a request, please?
Yeah, of
Yeah, Sierra, before you move on to your next question, I need you to hang up and call back in because I think it's your phone that we're getting a really strong echo from, and I don't know if everyone can hear it, but I can certainly hear it. And I'm just
keep
the show quality up.
I'm going to call you right back. I've got the number.
No, Richard, your number, I think you're okay. I think it's Sierra's phone. But Sierra, if you want to just ask your next question, and then while Richard's answering, you can call back in.
Absolutely.
Okay,
it sounded good to me, Sierra, but if the other people aren't hearing you right, then we can redo that.
Right, yeah, I hate to interrupt, but the quality has got to be up to a certain par. So,
no problem.
Ask your next question.
Sure. Richard, my next question was, what are some of your favorite documents that you've come across in your researching, in the past? And then I'll call back in.
Sure. Well, there's quite a few that I think are very, very important. I will say that I did an analysis of some of my favorite of these documents on my website, which is keyholepublishing.com. And on that site, I have an article that I wrote called 12 Documents Proving U.S. Government Interest in UFOs. What I try to do is to take some of the most powerful of these documents and have them displayed there so you can read them, but then I provide a little bit of an analysis to go along with them as well. Probably my favorite one that I just keep coming back to over and over is the Chadwell memo that I read a little while ago from 1952, in which the Director of Scientific Intelligence, H. Marshall Chadwell, said that, you know, there's something going on and we don't know what that is. To the director of the CIA. But another of my favorites is, I think, a very well-known, refers to a well-known case over Tehran in the nation of Iran from 1976. And this was a three-page detailed report from the Defense Intelligence Agency relating to a two attempts by F-4 interceptors of the Royal Iranian Air Force to intercept a UFO over Tehran. Now, this is back in the days of the Shah. This is before the Islamic Revolution that took place in 1979. So Iran was a key U.S. ally at the time. And as a result of this engagement with this UFO, the document went everywhere that mattered in the U.S. It went to the President of the United States. It went to the Director of the CIA, who at the time was George Bush Sr. The President, of course, was Gerald Ford. It went to the Director of National Security, who was Henry Kissinger, and went to a lot of other important people. And what it described is simply just absolutely remarkable, a case in which an object was seen over the city of Tehran. Lots of residents saw it. They called the local airport. And what they saw was this intensely bright object, just that didn't look like anything they'd ever seen before. The air traffic guy at the airport was like, yeah, right, sure, whatever, until he went out and looked at it, and he said, oh, my God, what is that? He called the Iranian Air Force, and they sent these two F-4s and in succession. And in each case, the F-4, and this is an excellent aircraft, got to within about a range of 25 nautical miles. And at that point, the pilots saw the object, super bright, got a radar lock, and in both cases, the object appears to have disabled the key electronics and avionics equipment of the aircraft as they approached. I mean, in other words, it just shut them off. They were able to fly, but they weren't able to do anything. In one case, one of the pilots was ready to fire a missile at this thing, and the missile system went offline. The object then detached a smaller object from it, which had intercepted one of the F-4s, which did an emergency turn to get away. All of this is on this detailed three-page, single-space type memo that made the rounds of the highest levels of U.S. national security. And we have that through the Freedom of Information Act in the glory era, the late 70s. I guarantee you, if this had happened in the last 10, 20 years, I doubt very seriously that we'd have been able to get this document pried out of the defense community. But it was it came out in the late 70s. There was a certain mood in the country at the time. There was a certain, probably the most politically and culturally liberal time of American history. This is, I would say, the late 70s. And that's when we were able to get this document.
Right.
There's quite a few others, but I think even if you look on a limited basis of like the top two or three or four or five of these government documents, it's very difficult to walk away and say, nah, there's nothing going on here. I think it's very difficult. And so when we started off this discussion regarding that NSA memo, I wasn't trying to minimize its importance. I think it is important. I'm not sure it says what some people believe it says. But the fact is that there are many official U.S. government documents that they're just incredible. And they do describe a reality that, according to their own, what they say publicly, is not supposed to be the case, but there it is.
Am I back on the air?
Yes, you are. And we're still having a little issue, but I think if you just try muting your phone when you're not talking, that might help.
Okay, perfect. Great, Richard. I think that thank you for saying that about the not minimalizing the thing before, because, as we start to, I often tell my friends when I'm speaking about these topics, I say when you have one piece of the pie or one piece of the picture, then it doesn't look to be very, like it doesn't amount to very much. But we start to put all these different pieces together from all the different arenas, all the different things, and you're up close and you're taking this piece, you're putting it next to this piece, you're putting it next to that piece, and you actually take about 10 or 12 steps back.
Right.
The whole picture adds up to something. And there's a whole, that's a whole of something. Can you start to speak about what you think the whole of the picture is? I mean, literally, to whatever degree you
well,
speak about that.
Well, let's dive into that rabbit hole. Let's do that. because the way that I looked at that picture has changed an awful lot, Sarah, over the last 10-plus years. I started looking at this topic very seriously about 16, maybe 17 years ago in the early to mid-90s, like 93, 94 is when I really started. And back then, I was Mr. Conservative in the sense that I didn't want to get into any weird stuff. Sure, it's UFOs, but hey, you don't have to talk about abductions. You don't have to talk about contact with other beings. I mean, gosh, that was just crazy. I didn't want to do any of that. I just wanted to, at the time, find a factual, reliable kind of history to guide myself by. But here's the thing. The longer you stay in this field, the more you investigate, the more you realize that this is a reality that we're not, most of us when we were growing up, were taught didn't exist. But there's something very, very unusual that is truly challenging to our overall paradigm of reality. So here's what I think is going on at this stage of the game. I think that, and we can take this step by step, but what I believe on a basic level is that we, humanity here on Earth, are of great interest to a variety of other intelligences that have the ability to monitor us and interact with us in various ways. We're interesting to them. We're not just little primitive natives running around the jungles or fighting each other. We're more than that to them. Now, that can be on several levels, the material, physical, technological level, and the spiritual level. Let me talk about the material level first. On a material level, it's very obvious that in the last 100 years or so, really the last several centuries since we've, as a civilization, sort of mastered science, we have been on the fast track to somewhere. Where that's going to head ultimately, I don't know if any of us knows, but it's something. And think of it this way. For thousands and thousands and thousands of years, our world was one in which people used horses and cows and bulls and animals and wooden tools and some stone and some metalworking here and there. And that was our world. We didn't really do science. We didn't have we didn't have electricity. We didn't have internet. We didn't have radio and TV. Suddenly, in the last century, it's like we go crazy, man. You know, we discovered the secret of science. And in that, we have transformed ourselves in the blink of a cosmic eye.
Yes.
I mean, when you think about how stable, in certain ways, our technology was for so long, and then suddenly, in the last 100 years, we've reinvented, almost literally reinvented, who we are, what we are as a civilization. I look at that change, and I realize we're not going to just stop in 2011. We're obviously going to keep going. So other entities who are observing us must know this. How can they not know this? So I think on that basis alone, we're of prime interest to them, because as they see it, we're about to jump right into their world. Because our progress is not linear. It's exponential. It's building on itself. It's like a rocket shooting straight up. So that's the technological material part of their interest. It seems to me that they must know we are about to have the ability to engage them in significant ways in which we had not maybe been able to do in the past. Whether that means as equals may be a different matter, but certainly as a force of our own to be reckoned with, I do believe that is going to be the case. We're on the verge, after all, of sentient machines, and we're on the verge of true interactivity and symbiosis between human and machine intelligence. And when you consider that that machine intelligence in another 20 or 30 years might include quantum computing, well, then hell, what are we going to be able to do? It boggles the mind. It boggles the mind. Okay, so that's the material level. Now, let's talk about matters of spirit. This is not something that I often write about. Doesn't mean that I don't believe in it, though. I happen to believe in a spiritual realm of existence. I happen to believe in a soul. And it's not just belief. It's I think that's what it is. I don't say that I know. The way that I look at it, I think it's, you know, based on my own study of this and related matters, my belief is that when this body of mine dies, that there's going to be a part of me that survives it, as it is for everyone listening, that will survive the death of that body and go on to a different type of incarnation or existence. And I suspect people listening are like, yeah, so that's pretty basic level information there. But I just wanted to lay that out on the table. Now, that being so, other entities that are visiting and watching us would also have an understanding of matters of spirituality and of the soul. They must. They must. And certainly what we have is an overabundance of testimony and claims by lots of people to have had a deep spiritual connection with some of these entities.
Yes.
So when you start, right, when you start looking at the whole grand picture, what I believe is the case is that, yes, there are other beings that are interested in us, some of them in a very, very positive, guiding type of way. Others, I'm not really convinced that that is the case. In other words, what I think is that simply by virtue of the fact that you might be more advanced intellectually or even spiritually doesn't necessarily, well, let me rephrase that. Simply because you may be more advanced intellectually and technologically doesn't mean that you're more advanced in a spiritual way necessarily.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And it seems to me when I look at all of the evidence as it's come to me, you got the good, the bad, the ugly, the indifferent, you got it all. They're all out there. There's the capability for truly angelic, godlike type of action. And then there's the capability for truly dark and, let's say, almost demonic type of activity, if you want to use that word. And I think that we're kind of stuck in the middle. We're part of this, not fully aware. Humanity is not fully aware that it's part of this grand game, but it's going on around us. Is it the same thing as how Christians would say, would describe the battle over the soul, you know, good and evil? I mean, it certainly can sound like that. I'm not sure that's what I'm saying here. I don't think that's what I'm saying. But I do think that we're dealing with a complex reality. And beyond that, it's not just that there are these other entities out there. We have our own human infrastructure, clandestine infrastructure, that I think is interested in all of this, and that is, to some extent, aware of what's going on. I've referred to them sometimes as the breakaway civilization. In other words, what I see is a deeply classified world, black budget world, that has been following this and trying to understand this phenomenon for many, many, many years. And they've been living in this reality for so long. They've been dealing with scientific concepts that are beyond our normal mainstream science, that all of this gives them a different kind of reality that they're living within, that I would say qualifies them, perhaps, to some extent, as a separate civilization, one that is broken away from our own, hence a breakaway civilization. So I think they're part of the overall picture. And what I personally believe that they do, and I don't think that they're even unified. I think that there may be factions within that. I've had a number of individuals over the years who've given me reason to believe that there are rifts or divisions of opinion among people, groups in the know. So if that's so, then you've got a kind of competition going on among these members, perhaps over knowledge, maybe over technology, and all that has to do with dealing in one way or another with this ET presence. I think it would be nice to have a scorecard to know who is working with whom here. But my sense is, and I have to be careful because I don't want to give the impression that I know more than I do, but the definite sense that I've gotten from some very either from just standard research and then from some interesting sources is that there's a kind of very complicated scenario being played out, almost like a Cold War, without our knowledge. And I think that may be the case.
Richard, can I ask you a question? I have always thought it was beyond coincidence that the technological revolution in this country, you know, when computers first appeared, that it happened after, 1947.
Yeah. Right.
Is that beyond coincidence that, we were already an industrial society, but it was nothing like it's been since 47.
Yeah, Ariel, you make a really good point. And, of course, many of us wonder about this. I've wondered about it so many times. What my personal take on that is as follows. I think that science, once you master certain scientific principles and technologies, that it's almost an inexorable, inevitable path. It's like putting a train on a track, and that track is going to take that train to a certain destination. So that, in other words, I think that science builds on itself, and that you do get this kind of exponential effect. So that, in theory, you could say that everything we have today, you know, including iPads and iPods and iPhones and everything else, that this could be a truly, homemade kind of technological development. What I think actually is the case is that we got a boost.
Right.
We got a boost from acquired ET technology. I do believe that we acquired such technology at Roswell, and I believe that it was acquired elsewhere as well. And so what it stands to reason that if you've got this exotic technology to study, that at a certain point you're going to have developments, you're going to have eureka moments, so to speak, in which you come up with a better way to achieve solid-state technology, integrated circuits, fiber optics, or any number of other developments. So that I think that ET tech would have given us ideas and would have enabled us to improve things that would have contributed to the advances that we have today. But I do think that ultimately we would have reached those on our own, maybe
right.
In our own way, maybe with a little more time.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to know because when you start getting into the world of private classified patents and things like this, I don't know if we're ever going to be able to get to the bottom of some of these, some of the key patents that have made our current world what it is. You're dealing with proprietary information in many cases. So it's hard to know for sure, but I think that we've gotten a boost from ET technology for sure.
Well, we also have what we call as, you know, we've got choice in the matter. And let me say what I'm saying about that is, even if we were handed bits and pieces of technology, we ultimately have a choice of which direction we're going to take things. The very first example is alternative fuels or oil-based fuels or alternative electricity or alternative ways to power things or the way we've been doing it. You know, it's the Tesla versus the
J.P. Morgan.
Yeah.
Right. You know, a way to do things. It's not that we don't have certain types of technology to even, you know, when Tesla made his power generating tower, and then they chose not to go with it, then that was a huge choice.
And that was J.P. Morgan, by the way, who pulled the financial rug from under Tesla's feet, by the way.
Correct.
That's right. He single-handedly undermined the whole alternative and led us down this path of pollution and
fossil fuel. What I think happened is that the advent of these objects caused the clandestine world to dust off anything that they had by Tesla and to really study it more carefully. Not just Tesla, but Thomas Townsend Brown, T. Townsend Brown, who was an American pioneer who followed in many ways in Tesla's footsteps in what we call electrogravitics. There's every indication that the work of Tesla and Brown was used very, very extensively to try to replicate what was being seen in terms of UFO technology. Now, some would argue, a colleague and friend Joseph Farrell has argued that that's primarily the source of UFOs, that it's not necessarily ET at all, but that it's human-derived Tesla tech. I don't believe that is the case. I think that what we're dealing with is something in which we've made some of these and we have not made some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that the advent of this phenomenon, which really got in high gear from the mid-1940s onward, caused a flurry of clandestine research and development, which included a huge amount of Tesla's work. And, of course, here's the thing. Once, you know, you can make breakthroughs to improve your conventional technologies and make money, you know, improve the electronics industry and all of this. But what if you have breakthroughs that are so important, so major, like a new source of fuel, like not petroleum, or electrogravitic breakthroughs, like anti-gravity, as it were, that you might decide, no, we're not sharing that with the world. I mean, hell, that would take down the petroleum industry. And they may not want to do that. They might think, well, first of all, what's wrong with having the rest of the people use petroleum? It's totally abundant, will never run out. In 1950, they thought that. In 1960, they thought, no, we're never going to run out of petroleum. Well, if this were 1960 levels of consumption, they would be right to a certain extent. It would last for several centuries, which was their projection at the time. But the fact is that this ain't 1960. Demand for petroleum basically doubles every generation. So you play the doubling game, and, well, forget it. You're not going to have enough. And that's
right.
The point where we're at now. That's what they call peak oil. And I think that the concept of peak oil is dead on exactly right. You can quibble over when it's going to happen, but the concept is simply, if that substance is not infinite, that is, if oil is finite, which it sure looks like to me, then at a certain point, you're going to get to a point where you have a peak in production, and that peak will then, after you pass that peak, your production will have to go down because you won't be able to get the same amount as you got before because it's just becoming a scarce resource. And particularly with ever-rising demand, it looks to many that the world may have already reached peak oil, or we're reaching it now. I think we have reached it, and that is one of the key things behind the oil prices that we're seeing these days. Some people are blaming it on the wars, which certainly is contributing. But fundamentally, we are at a point where the major oil fields in the world are old and showing severe signs of being getting, you know, way past their prime. But there's no let up in the demand that we have for petroleum, so it's a problem. Anyway, the point is, back in 1950s and 60s, the people making the decisions on UFO secrecy could easily say, well, yeah, let's just stick with oil. I mean, that's easiest, and we're making money hand over fist with that anyway, so why the hell give the people this other stuff, which would threaten to revolutionize the structure of power in the world? Because once you give people something akin to free and clean energy. Well, possibilities almost become endless for what people can do.
Absolutely.
And it could allow a great level of freedom, for good and for ill, by the way, but a lot of freedom that would perhaps allow people to be much more independent of the formal structures of power than they had before. After all, if you have a source of power to heat your home for free forever, well, there's one thing right there that you don't need the man for. You can just do your own thing.
The man doesn't like that.
The man don't like that.
No.
You know, back in the colonial period of American history, it was almost the same thing. American settlers, you know, in the eastern U.S., you've got the Appalachian Mountains as that was the great barrier to early settlement. And London, which, you know, ran the show, did not want the colonists going beyond that mountain range, because once they went past there, they couldn't control them. They couldn't tax them. People did want to go past the mountain range, though, so there was a constant struggle with the government in London, and it was one of the key causes of the grievances for the Revolutionary War. People didn't want to be penned in. They wanted freedom, and it would be the same thing with free energy today. That would give people a lot more independence from the structure of power. So that's a problem. Now, on the other side, it has to be said, free energy is not necessarily the total panacea. There are problems associated with it. This was one of the things that I tried to understand when I was writing AD After Disclosure with my colleague Bryce Zabel. I mean, think of it this way. Yeah, the source of whatever it is that allows these objects to go from point A to point B, it's obviously not petroleum. So let's say it's some form of revolutionary free energy. So that's great. So we translate that into a source of power for our own society, and everything's cool, until someone adapts that source of power for an incredible bomb that can, you know, blow up half of the oceans or major nations and things like that. I mean, it could be possible that some crazy person would be able to do that. So that the technology.
Case in point, if you believe in the theory of Atlantis, that was the same thing that happened. That we had technology of these massive, powerful crystals, and somebody got a little carried away and blew themselves up. So, you know, that's just sort of a theory of what you're speaking to now.
Well, right. I mean, the point is that the greater the source of power, think of nuclear power. I mean, my God, it's the most terrifying thing. This is what we do. We just cook up weapons. We create these weapons that can destroy the globe. Is it possible that this new form of energy could even have a greater destructive power than a nuclear weapon? Well, if that's the case, that's something that we have to look at forthrightly and very, you know, and courageously, and ask ourselves, if we were keeping the secret, we might just think about this and say, you know, we don't really have a way to control this once it gets out. What the hell are we going to do? Well, we can't let people know about it, that's for sure. Because if you give the kids matches to play with, they're going to do something stupid eventually. And so it's possible that it was not seen as a practical way to let this technology out without safeguards being in place. And here this is pure speculation. I'm basing this on nothing other than my own speculative thoughts on the matter. I haven't gotten this from any inside source or anything like that. But
absolutely.
I think it's really possible. Yeah. So it's complicated. I've supported and promoted what I would call disclosure on UFOs since I've been involved in this field, but I'm not without, the realization that it's complex. It's not a simple thing. Ultimately, I think it's going to happen whether people want it or not, just because you can't stop time from moving ahead. And no matter what you think of time, we're living in a time stream, and that time stream is not going to stop. We are developing very rapidly as a society, as people. And we're going to force the secret open despite ourselves, whether we want it or not. I tend to think it's going to be a real mess for for quite a while, but I don't think it'll be a mess forever. I do believe ultimately that we as a species need to have a true openness on this entire topic, because I think it's only this way that we will achieve true adulthood as a civilization, as humanity. We've been living in a kind of enforced childhood for a very, very long time, and I think it's time that we kind of stand up and step up and become what we are meant to be.
Absolutely. That is just perfectly said, Richard. You know, I've been watching, and I've mentioned this before to our listeners, is this Ancient Alien series, and they think that they've just done a brilliant job of, again, when things are broken up and sparse and you don't have all of the picture, all the pieces put together in such a manner where it could just speak for itself, as they've done so well in the Ancient Alien series, is we don't even have real knowledge of our true history.
No, that's right. Absolutely. We have, I call it a hole in our history. I think that's
correct.
Really what we have. I'm very interested in this. I'm trained, my true love is history. I've studied it my whole life, and that includes ancient right on through to, you know, yesterday, today. Our ancient history, you know, you think about even officially speaking, humanity, according to like any official archaeologist and student of this, if you look like 15, 20,000 years ago, you had fairly primitive modern human beings, but living in a very primitive kind of existence as hunter-gatherers and sort of semi-nomadic in various parts of the world, doing cave art, right, and this type of thing. And according to that way of looking at what we are as a species, we didn't really do much until we invented agriculture, which would have been, say, roughly 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 years ago in various stages and places in what is now the Middle East. And then we didn't invent writing, according to this theory, until about 5,000 years ago, a little more than that, in ancient Sumer and then in Egypt. So that's the official story. And now the problem with that is that there is reason to believe that somewhere in those many thousands of years, a great civilization rose and fell in between that.
Absolutely.
Right.
Because our technology now has caught up, is advanced enough now that we can do all types of dating. And when we start coming up with things that are 10 to 15,000 years ago, it just blows that whole first portion you said completely out of the water.
Yeah, I think there are very good reasons to believe that, you know, 10 to 12,000 years, 12 to 14,000 years ago, there could very well have been an advanced civilization that would be the foundation for what we, you know, call Atlantis and so forth. It's taken me a long time to come to that conclusion, but yes, I do think that this is a very strong argument. And by the way, after I finished my third volume of History of UFOs in the National Security State, that's a three-volume study that'll cover the whole modern period of the UFO reality and cover-up, I do intend to write a prequel, which would deal with all of the ancient evidence for the reality of this phenomenon and everything related to it, indicating that the possibility or likelihood that we've had other intelligences acting on us throughout our history. And I will be doing that. I'll get to that in a couple of years, but it's definitely on my agenda.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Well, yeah.
That's what we're speaking about now is,
right,
with full disclosure or with any kind of information where the powers that be or this breakaway group or whomever it is that's taken liberty and taken our freedom away from us that is actually communicating one-to-one with the extraterrestrials or the others. You know, they have all this information and they have all these things that, basically information that is seriously lacking for the general population. And if we were to ever become the people we are meant to be, We are to have all of the information, we are to know all of our history, and we are to be given the freedom and the choice to move forward as a civilization, as humankind.
Well, I absolutely agree, Sierra. The biggest problem that I see in a post-disclosure world is that we may not have all the information that we want. It may be a very frustrating experience. This might be the great irony of disclosure, at least for many, many years. Think of it this way. My own vision of how this can happen is sort of as follows. I think within a few years, I was recently quoted as saying as early as 5 years from now, which is possible. It could also be 10 years. It could be 20 years. But within the lifetimes of most people listening to this right now, I think it's very likely that that something's going to be forced, that the President of the United States and other world leaders will be forced into admitting that this is real. And the reason they will be forced is because of one of a couple of reasons. Either a major event is going to happen that will make it different from back in the 90s and the 80s and so on, because now everyone's going to have their own portable HD little mini cameras attached to their phones. It's going to happen in the next 5-10 years, I think, where HD cameras are going to be very, very common. And what do you think the odds are that something's going to happen and you're going to have like 10 or 20 or 30 people recording the same thing, and it's going to be out there? And at a certain point, I believe something is going to make the breakthrough that's going to force an admission. Now, it could be that, or it could be a WikiLeaks type of event in which documents are forced out that cause a great embarrassment and force an admission. It could be simply the fact that our computer technology is going to go so far ahead from where it currently is that it will have sort of like an end run around the current blocks of secrecy that are happening right now in ways that I can't even imagine. But I think it's foolish to assume that we're not going to have better tools at cracking the secrecy in the future. So whatever the case is, though, I think that it will force an admission. I do not believe that there is going to be a voluntary disclosure of the reality of this. I don't even think it's possible for a president to be able to do that, because I'm not of the opinion that the president is really fully briefed on everything that's happening. What I think has happened is that this secret has gone so deep, so classified, privatized, that there's really no motivation for these people to give it up. But they'll be forced to. They'll be forced to because the president will be forced to make some kind of, to throw the people a bone and say, yes, this does appear that this isn't our own civilization doing this. And once that happens, that's going to open the floodgates for all kinds of questions. And these questions may not be easy to answer. People are going to want to know, first of all, who are these other beings and do we have anything to worry about? I guarantee you that'll be the first question on the minds of many, many billions of people. And it may not be easy to answer that. First of all, prying the answer out of the classified world may take many, many class action lawsuits. It may not just happen even if the president asks for it. We have to keep that in mind. And then the other thing is that even if they give us the information they know, we have to be careful as to whether or not that information is truthful. And we have to then, even if it's truthful, we don't know how accurate or complete it is. It's not clear to me that even the guys who've got all the secrets know everything. Do they know for sure that these beings are from other planets? Do they know for sure that these beings are from another dimension of reality, whatever that means? In other words, we're going to be debating this for many years after disclosure. You'll have evangelical Christians who will interpret this phenomenon in a way very different than, let's say, the higher consciousness, New Age crowd is going to be looking at it. You're going to have two very different fundamental perspectives on the nature of this. In other words, there are going to be people who look at this activity as primarily demonic and Luciferian. You can count on it. And there are going to be other people who are going to be looking at this phenomenon as a very positive, you know, let's reach out to these other beings who are here to help us. And there may not be any common ground here for many years, maybe for generations, until we resolve as a society what we really believe is going on here. You know, it may be messy.
Yes, and I understand what you're saying. You know, as a sentient being myself, and I've mentioned in the prior shows, having the walk-in experience, a braided walk-in, in which one of these higher beings that we were talking about that are benevolent, has made a particular kind of contact with me to have information be released, to try and get human beings from the inside to rise up and take responsibility for the whole of who they are, where they come from, and where they're going. And there's another scenario that there are enough people wake up, and we're already starting to see it in a way where so many people are so uncomfortable with the way things are happening right now.
Right.
You know, from, you know, the economy to everything. You know, let's look at our lives. Each one of you, just reflect on your life for a moment. Everybody's really uncomfortable right now. Until we get to the point where we stand up and say, you know what, this just isn't working anymore. We demand to have alternatives put in place. We demand to have full disclosure. We demand as a people to either, you know, replace the people who can't do it for us or replace the model entirely. But it's going to take, you know, it's for so long it's been the masses allow a very few to make the choices and make the decisions. And it's going to have to get to the point where those masses stand up and say, this no longer works. These models don't work. You know, economy doesn't work. The way the school system doesn't work. The way the banking, all of it, it all goes to the few, to the elite,
right,
to the powerful. And we as a people, with loving hearts, not like I'm saying go out there and riot for Christ's sake. You know, we're talking about standing up and having a conversation with our local politics, with our local people, with even the people within our own family and our friends, to look around and say, listen, folks, this isn't going to get any better without our involvement here. What does that look like?
Well, boy, I'm so glad you mentioned this. I think you really crystallized the problem and the feelings that we have very well. It seems to me, I was listening to you discuss this, Sierra, and what we really have, I think, is it comes down in a lot of ways to energy. if you look at the last several hundred years of our society, all right, everything, you know, from railroads to development of the petroleum industry to then to automobile industry and to the school system and all of these things that are in place, these major parts of our infrastructure, they're all hierarchically controlled, of course. They're all owned by very large, powerful corporations, which are themselves owned in large part by the true elite wealth holders of the world. And we all kind of know this. So that, in other words, they're also now trying to own all the water and own all the stuff in the world. These people are getting their hooks into to own. But what happens if there is an answer here in UFO technology having to do with energy, making it relatively free and very cheap and portable? If that is the case, that is, in terms of our global infrastructure, the most incredible game changer of everything, because that will allow people almost instantly a level of freedom and independence in their lives that has really never existed in large measure for humanity. Because with your own source, with your own energy source, literally, I was going to say the sky is the limit, but the sky is not even the limit. Space, the universe is the limit.
Yes.
You could have your own propulsive craft that could take you wherever you want to go, in theory. And with free energy, you could mine another planet or moon of another planet, create your own oxygen, create your own food, ultimately. Do your own thing beyond control of any other authority, at least in theory.
Ultimately, and I agree with that, Richard, is ultimately what we're getting back to, or what we're getting to here, and what the message is that continues to come through all different kinds of sources, is that it's not all about the technology. It's about a way of life. It's about human beings going back to a way of balance. Not getting up and being driven and working 40 to 60 to 70 hours a week to support stuff,
right,
because it's the way that the current situation is set up.
Right.
But to actually have, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, and one of the ways that life is displayed back then is you go to what you are naturally inclined to do is what your work is. Not what you have to do to make a living, not what you have to do to pay the car bill, the mortgage, all of it, to eat. Even that is crumbling underneath us as we are standing here looking around and what do we do? What do we do? Who do we turn to? Because who we're turning to and who we have turned to up to this point has let us down grossly. It's about coming back to the way that we are supposed to live on this planet and as sentient beings as a balanced way.
Yeah, well, what we're seeing, what we're dealing with right now is the crumbling of an infrastructure that is based on an old energy paradigm. And you know, the thing about energy is the relationship between energy and economic growth it's an exact one-to-one ratio, in the sense that if you have cheap, abundant energy, you will have economic growth. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about this. That's just how it is. If you have scarce and expensive energy, you will not have economic growth. It's very simple. And what we have seen in the last couple of hundred years is, like in the early years of petroleum, from the 1860s onward, petroleum was, for the most part, pretty easy to get. Heck, you know, you go down to parts of Texas in the early 20th century, stick your finger in the ground, and you'd hit oil, practically. It was almost that easy. And so with the situation like that, we saw in the world massive economic development all through most of the 20th century. And that started to change in the 1970s when we hit our first oil crisis. Now we're at a problem where this oil cannot get us to the end zone here. It cannot take us to where we need to be. If, as it certainly looks like, there is a new answer to energy within the UFO phenomenon, this promises all of the things you're talking about: greater wealth, real wealth for everyone, greater leisure time so that we can pursue things and not have to work 60 plus hours a week like so many of us do. It's really gotten ridiculous. Compared with the 1950s and 60s, by the way, you know, our grandparents, they were hardworking people, but many of them did not have to work all these hours. And keep in mind, back in those years, not nearly as many women were full-time wage earners. I mean, we had an economy back then that was able. You know, you could have the husband do a full-time job, one full-time job, and that would be enough to pay the mortgage of a house and raise a family. And, I mean, my God.
And not a small family, you remember? Back
no,
in
right.
The day, we're talking 4 to 6 children, sometimes 8 and 10 children back then, you know, from the baby boomers, and they were able to sustain it. I have a question for you, Richard.
Yeah.
What do you think that the elite are playing at here? Because in one sense, as we're talking about this, we understand that it's an old model and it cannot continue to carry us forward, but what keeps them so stuck in the game of the oil energy? What is not having things shift fast enough? Because as we see, let's start looking around us again with all the different things, the tornadoes, the earthquakes, the yada, yada, yada.
Right.
You know, some people speak to technology. Some people have this theory that all the oil's been taken out of the crust of the earth and then, you know, it's making things shift around and get all messed up. I mean, whatever it is, what do you think this elite is playing at? I mean,
I think, it could very well be a case of, fiddling while Rome burns. These people have every material need met and beyond that, and they don't really look at the rest of humanity. This has to be said. They don't look at the rest of us as fully human in the sense that they are. There's been a lot of inside analysis done on this mentality that the super rich have. Not just the, you know, your local millionaire down the street. I mean, we're talking about the elite of the elite of the elite. All right, those people with the preponderance of power and wealth at the very top of our human food chain don't look at us the way we look at us. They see themselves at the top, and there's a tendency frequently to look at the rest of humanity as, just ballast to the ship. There's a great interview that was done with the late, I'm drawing a complete blank. It was the man who created America Freedom to Fascism. Oh, Aaron Russo, thank you. Aaron Russo was a kind of a cool guy. He did three classic movies, a classic comedy, a classic musical, and a classic documentary. The comedy was Trading Places with Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. The musical was The Rose with Bette Midler. He produced that. And then he produced America Freedom to Fascism, which is a great, great documentary on the transformation of America. What Aaron Russo said, and this is an interview you can find on YouTube, shortly before he died, a couple of years ago, he talked about his friendship with Nicholas Rockefeller. What had happened is that Russo had made some waves among the elite because of his movie and because of his local political activism. And as he put it in this interview, he said, they didn't really try to kill me. They just wanted to buy me off, which is really what they do. They'd rather not kill you. They'd rather just bring you over to their side and shut you the hell up. And so he was courted by Nick Rockefeller, one of the Rockefeller family members, of course. And they became friends. They got along pretty well. But they were never the same. They never saw reality the same way. And according to Russo, at one point Rockefeller said to him, why do you care about these people? And Russo, who was a very working-class kind of guy, he didn't even understand the question. He said, well, what do you mean? Why do I care? I mean, I just care. But from Rockefeller's point of view, it's like, why do you care about these masses of humanity? They don't matter. And as a matter of fact, it was during this interview that Russo then said, Rockefeller said to him, this was in October of 2000, this is 1 month before the election of George Bush over Al Gore, okay, where Rockefeller predicted what would happen on 9/11. He said, just so you know, it's all worked out. Planes are going to crash into buildings. People are going to think it's terrorists. Ha, 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 ha. He was like laughing about it. And Russo was horrified. And then, of course, when 9/11 happened, he put that together and said, this is what Nick Rockefeller was telling me. But the point being that that's just one of many, many insights into that world. They don't look at us as equals in any way. So are we expendable? This is a long-winded answer to your question. Do they look at us as expendable? And I guess I'd say the answer is sure. In a pinch, we're expendable. We're only valuable insofar as we provide wealth to them. And if we're not doing that, then what the hell do they need us for? There's almost 7 billion of us. We are, after all, sucking down the resources of this world pretty fast. And anyone can see that. So from their point of view, would they want a depopulation? Well, maybe they would, as long as they can be assured that, that they will survive, right? Maybe in their
last time I checked, they live on this planet, too. And the way that things are going and the way that things are starting to spin out of control, I can bet you that they're stepping back going, wow, okay, we didn't think that this was going to happen. You know, unless they're planning on living off planet someplace, they, too, have to reap the repercussions of action.
I do agree with you. And, you know, a couple of things. Certainly there are lots of people at the top who I shouldn't really characterize them all as this way, but there are people like that. There are people who look at us as just fodder, but there are other people who don't, clearly, and so they're not all going to agree on this. And the other thing is, yes, they have to live on planet Earth. I mean, honestly, why would you want to go to Mars? Even if you could, Earth is where it's at, baby. This is the place. We've got beautiful trees. We were designed to live on Earth. This is where we're supposed to be. All right. There's no other place in the universe that's going to be better for the human body than planet Earth. That's what we're supposed to be living on. So yes, one would think they would care. But the question is, they might be wondering, well, what's the best way to preserve planet Earth with fewer people? Well, they might be thinking that. After all, you know, kill off some of the excess, right? And, hey, now, this has taken me somewhat far afield from my normal studies. I don't usually write about this type of thing. And, I mean, I do think about it a lot, and I think it's possible that this is going on. But I do think that we, humanity, the masses, are not without our own resources here. One, we have the ability that we've developed in the last couple of decades to talk to each other in ways that we've never been able to do before. We have the web and everything associated with that, so that we can have a global conversation with each other that, I mean, in an age when many of us are talking about awakening and waking up from the slumbers, right, that we've been in, the process of communicating via the web is contributing to a great awakening, I think, among many, many millions of people, and maybe billions, ultimately.
And this is key. This is key for the direction that we're moving, because if we start thinking as an individual symbiotic thing and start thinking from the whole, that we are all connected, and it is a global conversation about what's happening, where we're headed, and who we are as a human species. Once we start acting and speaking and being pulled forward into our future from that place, everything will shift.
Yeah,
I wonder
when this is going to happen. I often wonder how long is this going to take. A lot of folks say it's going to happen in late 2012. I hear many people talk about the ascension and awakening. I personally think it's going to take a little longer than that before we really get to a point where we, as a global species, reach a point where we truly are aware sufficiently to be able to act in a positive way toward getting ourselves out of the mess that we're in. But I do have faith and confidence that we can do it. Just seems that December 2012 is coming up pretty close, and I'm not seeing it happening yet.
Well, the main thing that we need to do as people is to shift this paradigm of thinking that somebody else will do it, that somebody else, the people, you know, and very simply that the old model, an old way of doing everything just doesn't fit who we are as a people, as a planet, and where we're headed, and actually start taking action individually towards something with a different outcome.
Well,
I
agree.
I could remind you of what Lavendar has said, is that it is not as much a matter of a date on a calendar as it is a sequence of events that will determine the timing of when disclosure happens, when awakening, ascension. I mean, when you wake up on December 22nd, 2012, the world's going to look just the same outwardly, but there is a group consciousness, and I don't know exactly, there's a formula that I can't quite recall, that if maybe it's only 10% of the world's population has an increase in their own personal frequency, an increase in, if you want to call it spirituality, awareness, consciousness, that it is enough to tilt the scales in favor of a more rapid ascension. I hate to keep using that word because it's not really accurate, but it's an evolution of spiritual development that's been going on for a long time. So, and again, as Lavendar has taught us and myself, that if you just work at being the highest being that you know how, being as gracious and loving and kind and maintaining your alignment and commitment to that higher frequency, that everywhere you go, you're going to be leaving little seeds behind that will help more crops of like kind grow.
Yeah.
So, and I think the thing is only about 10% of the world's population needs to achieve that to put us on a different track.
Well, I think that's very beautifully expressed, Ariel. And since I also would agree, generally speaking, I think about the 10% part of it. After all, look, real change in this world is always done by a minority of people, a minority of engaged, aware people. And it's always been like that. And in fact, I think 10%, it may not even be necessary to have that many. It could be 5%. As I recall, there was a study done by the, this is taking us a little bit afield, but not so much, by the Chinese military during the Korean War on American prisoners of war. And what they decided, what they discovered, is that out of every 20 soldiers, captured prisoners, there was usually one who was like the leader. And if you, and they made a point of separating that 5% of this, of the population of prisoners from the rest. And if you took those out, then the other 95% were very, very easy to manage. So that, in other words, their own discovery was that it was essentially 5% of the group, of the population, were the ones that you had to really watch out for.
Uh-huh.
And so on that basis, you might say maybe if 5% of the world were to achieve a certain deep understanding of, let's call it, higher consciousness, that yes, that maybe that could do it. That could lead the rest of us into a much better place, a much better understanding of where we need to be as a society. And maybe
right,
that could start at the end of 2012. Why not? Why not?
Well, you see, each one of us certainly has dominion over their own reality. And, I mean, I know in my house, I'm the boss. So, I mean, starting from this really small, like microcosm reality of my own, and everyone in their individual space create this bubble of higher frequency of, you know, don't get caught up in the fear and the stress and the money and the this and the that. It's just you change your focus and keep it at least 55% of the time on the type of reality that you do want to live in. And certainly it branches out from there, but like they say, it starts at home.
Yeah. Well, I guess I agree with you. I'm not going to disagree, but I would just add that there are broader infrastructure issues relating to our world that, I mean, after all, if there's no economy and there's no food to buy, then you might suggest, and there's no food to buy for your kids or your grandchildren.
Right.
Then you might say, well, higher consciousness sounds great, but I got to eat.
Right, right. Well, that's why That's why we've been telling everyone in our readings, just make sure you've got 3 months' worth of food and water. It's always
yeah.
a good idea.
Yeah.
Absolutely. To never be caught with your guard down.
I stock up. I mean, not because I think that society is going to collapse, but as a hedge against inflation and higher prices. I have a nice collection of dried beans and other kinds of non-perishables in my house. Because I just have a feeling that prices are going up. So I've got a nice little supply there.
But going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, Ariel, I think that we all have, it speaks to the different groups of people that are here on planet Earth. But my point being is that somebody, there have to, whether it's five, you know, we go back to the 5% of the leaders, 5% of the people who actually step out and say, this just doesn't work anymore, and we demand that other structures be put into place. Nothing's going to change until that happens, you know. Mm-hmm. And I believe that it's also many, many pieces and parcels to the same game, many, many different paths to get to the same point. And those that can hold the space and raise their consciousness at home and do what there is to be at home. But there's those of you out there, listeners, and I know you know who you are, that need to get up and step outside your door and walk up to your Capitol or write your congressman or get involved in a way that has an impact on the way that things are. Because if we continue to sit back and let somebody else do it, it's never going to get done.
Yeah, yeah. It takes getting off our duffs and actually engaging the world. I often wonder, you know, how will the global process of higher consciousness take place? And I don't think that I've thought this out any more than either of you have, or many of the people listening. But I look at a couple of things in our world and ask myself, are we moving? Like, what is moving us to a higher consciousness? It's not our major media. It's not our political institutions. It's not, you know, it's not like the newspapers that most people read, for example, or the television shows that most people watch. It's not the educational institutions that are in place in general. I don't think that they're leading us to it. So, in other words, the main institutions of our society, I don't really think, are doing a good job at all in helping great numbers of people to achieve what I would call a higher consciousness, something to get you beyond Monday Night Football or American Idol. But there is this kind of growing kind of grassroots movement of consciousness that is out there. And this show that, you know, I'm lucky enough to be on tonight, this is one example of it. So that might be a help. I suspect, though, that we may not really achieve a real breakthrough until a disclosure actually is made of this ET reality.
Absolutely. It's a key part of what's going to happen. Again, back to the sequence of events that's happening.
Well, right. But, I mean, my take on it is, like, most people just go through their lives bopping around doing their thing, you know, going to work, watching TV, making dinner, hanging out with the family, kind of like the same old thing. And we get stuck, like, in our own little private world there. Not really much of a higher consciousness for the most part. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I've got lots of friends and family, and I love all these people. Plus, I deal with a lot of people in just the ordinary daily life that has nothing to do with UFOs. And to be perfectly candid with you, I don't see an awful lot of higher consciousness of the way that we are talking about it on this show. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not there, and it doesn't mean that there isn't a hunger for it. What I find is that people do have a hunger for deeper knowledge. They're just not aware of it until they meet someone who's willing to turn on some light bulbs. And then they're
exactly.
Like, oh, God,
and that goes back to it goes back to the conversational piece, too.
Right.
Some people are just waiting. There are conversations waiting to happen. You have no idea what sparks happen and
absolutely.
You know, if you're crossing a pebble into the pond, what happens when you're willing to just bridge a conversation with your family and friends about any one of these topics, and it's where the way people get shaken awake And I wanted to mention here, you were, as you were talking, what popped in my mind is something that Lavendar sent to me a couple weeks ago. It was a video she sent to me. It's called Wayseer. And there's this gentleman that's just absolutely brilliant, and it's wayseer.com. You all should go on and watch this video. It's just absolutely amazing. It talks to the very few people who, like you were just speaking to, Richard, that, you know, there's those of us who just vibrate at a certain frequency and we're constantly tapped into the higher consciousness stuff. And it's our job to be the spark in the darkness, to light the light bulbs of the people around us and get them going.
I do agree. I think it's the job of everyone who gives a darn, who cares, and to try to help that process along. I guess I was just going to say, though, that my hunch is that the real event that might kickstart a massive awakening would be a disclosure of this reality. And the reason would be that, I mean, just imagine, you know, billions of people who have just been kind of living their life thinking that their reality was, that was the reality. And suddenly they become aware of the actual existence of other entities, whether for good or for ill, whatever they are, that operate at a different level than what we ordinarily operate at, in some key ways, obviously. All right, whatever that happens to be, that information will come out at some point. And what we're going to have is a world of humanity asking itself the same question. And that question is, have I been wasting my whole life? I think people really will want to know this. They're going to realize, look at all the stupid things I've been concerned about. And here are these other beings. They're not like that. In other words, they show by their very existence an example of a different way to be conscious in one's existence, a different way to function.
Exactly.
That'll be a wake-up call to a lot of people. And that doesn't mean that we'll want to emulate whatever these other beings are. What it means is that we're going to force ourselves to grow up very, very quickly, maybe traumatically in certain cases. Because, look, if you really have been wasting your life, and make no mistake, many people have been wasting their life, that's not an easy thing to come to terms with for anybody. It's going to come to a lot of, you know, to recognize that you've abused other people, that you've been abused, but that you've, mostly that you've hurt other people. And any of us who looks at our lives honestly and deeply, it's hard to avoid that. In other words, what I think will happen is that this disclosure, this mass awakening that it will cause, it will be a very difficult process, but a very necessary process, so that we can then, I think, become, well, let's say it, a better version of what we are now. I think that's really possible.
Well, that's great. We know, Richard, we have a few callers with questions, and I've just noticed that this time with you has flown by. We only have about 15 minutes left, so if you don't mind, I think we'd like to hear from some of our listeners with questions on this topic. Okay, we're going to hear from, let's see, this Sarah or Sora at Area 757. That's right. Okay. Sora, you're on the air. Do you have a question for Richard Dolan?
Yeah. Hi, Richard Dolan. It's so nice to meet you. You have a wonderful energy, a soothing voice.
Thank you.
My question is, and I've been following things quite closely, kind of in retrospect for years. A friend referred me here. My question is, if the ultimate plan of these people in these high positions is to only have the earth for their genetic protege and no one else, is where does that leave the rest of us who feel in tune, star-seeded, who have children we know are star-seeded? Where does that leave our children?
Okay, well, that's an interesting question. First of all, we have to know, is it the plan of the elites only to have the world inherited by their progeny, their genetic branches. I'm not sure that that is exactly a plan of theirs, although I guess I wouldn't want to rule anything out. I will share something with you. I don't think I've ever shared this anywhere, but it's my own belief, and this is only my belief, that I tend to believe in multiple existences. I guess you can say I believe in reincarnation. And that not everyone who's here comes from the same place. So you talk about star seeds, I guess that's what that would be. And that's my own best hypothesis right now. If that's so, then we would have to assume, right, that those beings would be monitoring their own on this world. It would make sense to me. Maybe that would explain why certain people feel that they're protected through various difficulties in their life. I guess the only way I would answer what you're saying, what you're asking, is that if there is a plan among the human elite to allow, say, most of humanity to die off, I don't think this is a slam dunk for them. I think that we as a species have a lot of resources on our side, and that there are three major players in what's going on right now in the world. There are these other beings, whether one or many of them, I think there's many of them. Then there are the secret keepers, or let's call them the elites at the top of our pyramid. And then there's the rest of us. And in fact, I think that we, the people, are the real interesting dynamic of this equation. And I think it's we that are going to be forcing open the gates of secrecy. And I think it's we, the people, that are going to be ultimately enabling this world to be to move on to the next level of our development.
Yeah, but my question is, are we going to be enabling that development into that collective consciousness through sacrifice? And I'm talking blood sacrifice, like life sacrifice and rebirth, into their collective. Or are we going to be enabling it through actually being able to participate in this lifetime?
If I could speak to that, I think
okay.
I understand what you're asking, Sora. Ascension is a kind of a misused term. This is about evolution, and when we are moving into the next age, if you want to call it, it's going to be about alignment. If you are in alignment with these higher frequencies, then you go with them. You it doesn't matter about whose DNA you're carrying. It's, are you aligned to the Earth itself? And if people who cannot evolve, who cannot give up the greed and the domineering and all that, if they can't give that up, then they are not in alignment. They're the ones that are going, and I don't care how much money they have. So that's just my take on it.
Well, I think I do not believe that we're going to have a mass die-off.
No.
I think we'll have some difficulties, and we may have some very big crises, but I don't think that we're going to have a mass die-off. But we are going to have a reconfiguration of how we as a society are organized, and I think that'll have to include new political structures, new energy paradigms, and a new spirituality. All of those will be. But I don't think that it'll involve a massive die-off.
Yeah, that's our concern. And thank you for putting me at ease with that. That's comforting.
All we can do is our best. And look, I try to look at this world as fearlessly as I can. I don't want to have it rose-colored glasses over my face. But I also, I'm very skeptical of people who... it almost seems that they live on fear, and they promote every new crisis that comes up, every new opportunity that they have to scare the hell out of people. And I just think that that's, A, it's not accurate, and it's also not responsible.
And it's also a ticket to nowhere. Yeah. So we're going to move on now because we have a couple of more callers and only 10 minutes left of the show. So thank you so much for calling in, Sora. And if you are not already a member of the of our forum, please join. And there's a lot of people that can help you with more questions. So thank you for calling in.
Thank you again. You all are wonderful.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're going to hear very quickly from our own Doc Belva. Hello, Belva. You're on the
Hi,
air.
Hi, how are you?
We've only got a couple of minutes. We're great, but...
Okay, I've got about four questions.
Okay.
Four things I want to talk about. I don't want to go all the way back to your beginning, but back in the 50s, I had a sports car, and I broke my fan belt, and they came and gave me a new fan belt.
Sweet.
So that was in the 50s, and that's when I went to Giant Rock, and when I was there, that's when I bought the book called Proceedings, and it told all of the secret things that had been taught to Van Tassel concerning advanced things, engineering things, and he was very busy doing a lot of the things that they had taught him.
Okay.
And he had this enormous meeting on Labor Day, every Labor Day. One time it was so big, there was 10,000 people out in the middle of the desert, and it took two pages of Life magazine to cover all the people, from wall to wall, mountain to mountain. It was amazing. And they had a thing called Project Blue Book, and you didn't mention that. And I met most of the men that were involved in Project Blue Book.
Okay.
And also, when I went, I was in California, and I had moved from L.A., where I was when I met George, down to San Diego. And I had a friend that had three Tesla cars that ran on water. They were red, and they were Oldsmobiles. And one was in San Francisco, one was in L.A., and one was in San Diego.
Wow. Can I ask you, Belva, can I just jump in? Because I've heard many stories of there's a news story, you can even find this on YouTube, of a car that ran on waters back in the early 1980s. But are you saying that you yourself saw these cars that ran on water?
Oh, yeah. I had my picture made with one of the car in San Diego.
Wow. Okay.
But he died. I mean... I don't know what happened to him. He disappeared. And the cars disappeared.
Yeah, well, the guy who, there was a story about him from, I think, around 1980 or so. He also died. And there's a video of this guy driving his car, and he said it ran on any kind of water, even the skunkiest, you know, brackish water. Didn't matter.
Right.
Wow.
And
I just got through
with a man that introduced the water thing for the whole town where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And, by the way, I live three blocks from Tesla's house. And the mountain that you can see...
In Colorado, or...?
Yeah, in Cripple Creek.
And you knew George Van Tassel. Well, you've had some pretty interesting experiences, I must say.
A lot of years. And we had Mount Pisgah here. This is where he put the light bulbs in the mountain, and they... Mm. Burned without electric cords or anything.
Well, that's wonderful. Did you have a question for me?
Well, I wanted to say one of the secrets for people would be not to have judgment.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, if we don't have hate and we don't have fear and we don't have those things, I think when I had cancer and 3 months to live back in 1970, that I learned it was a blessing because I had to learn all of that so I could help other people. And I found that that was the blessing. And the fact that they said I was non-compliant and canceled my hospitalization was another blessing, and that's why I'm still here.
If I may just thank you for that. A beautiful thought.
Yes. Thank you. It's always good to hear from you. We only have a couple minutes left, and I do have one more caller. So thank you so much, sweetie, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
I would just like to add on to what Belva said about judgment. If I have any philosophy in the world, I don't read UFO books at night. What I read are books on Zen, actually. If there's any philosophy that I have, that would be that. And it's a long road, man, to try to not have judgment, but that's what that's all about too. And I do feel that she's right, that ultimately for our own mental and spiritual health, that is the way to go.
No doubt. Well, we have one more call, and it is from Jen. Hi, Jen. We've only got 4 minutes.
Hey,
so
guys.
You're on.
I wasn't even certain that I would be able to get on this evening, and quite frankly, you all touched on some rather amazing topics tonight. Actually, you've pretty much answered all of my questions. But, you know, Richard,
I can't believe that. There's no way they answered everything.
I know. It's amazing. Well, every question I had would pop up in conversation at some point because this really just evolved into something really fantastic. But the thing I did want to say is one of the things that I enjoy most about having you on the show is that you really draw us back into, you know, we often talk about the etheric pieces of all of this. And when we have you on the show, it brings context to this material world that we live in as well. And it also helps us to bring back into perspective the true historically human reaction to various types of earth-shattering, if you will, events.
Yeah.
And I always find that really refreshing. So I
well, thank
truly
you.
Enjoy having you on the show.
Appreciate that very much. It was hard, you know, in writing AD After Disclosure with Bryce Zabel, which we were a year ago at this time, we were in the throes of writing that book. It was all new to us because what we tried to do is exactly that, to envision the material physical world that we live in. Like,
right.
What would happen? What would actually happen if and when this information comes out, which it will? And that was
right.
Hard. It was I'm glad we did it.
Well, you know, I actually do have a question. I'm thinking about it.
Sure.
Since you've been on the show numerous times, is there anything from this experience, from this exchange with this particular audience of people, and I know you have similar audiences that you interact with fairly regularly, but since those interactions have started taking place with your work dealing with the UFO phenomena, have these interactions broadened certain perspectives or influenced certain new perhaps paths that you've been looking into? I'd be curious to see how these interactions have been influencing you personally.
That's a fair question to ask, and certainly, look, any of the paths that we walk on, all of us, we're going to be influenced by other intelligent, thoughtful people that we meet, and it's no different with me. I'm sure that that's the case. Now, one thing that I cannot, and really I think do not ever want to escape, is my own intellectual training and my training as a historian primarily. And really what that has taught me is that when I evaluate evidence, I have to evaluate it on the basis of, I have to evaluate how do we know what we know is what it comes down to.
Right.
And so when I get information from individuals that is based on something that I cannot personally confirm, that is a vision that they may have, a telepathic connection to another entity, none of which I deny, by the way. But because I can't always confirm these things personally, I have to hold them at a slightly in a different place than I would other types of evidence that I can confirm.
Right.
So for
so
me,
just,
yeah,
have
I have
to,
to I have
got,
to grade the
seconds
evidence
here.
Yeah. So I don't dismiss this. In fact, I firmly believe that there are other dimensions of reality that we are all part of, and so I embrace that. And it's just a matter of when I deal with it as a public persona to try to make sure that I weigh the evidence in a way that's going to be legitimate for me.
You
well,
know
I
what,
love
real quickly,
really quick.
We need to wrap this up, and I do want to thank Richard. I hate getting cut off before
we
we're done with the show. So, yes, Richard, this time has just flown by, and only happens with the most interesting people, I'm sure. Sierra, thank you, and Richard.
I loved it.
Jen,
it was great.
Purple Sage, thank you so much. You handled the chat room and the switchboard tonight. We so appreciate that. Lavendar will be back next week, and you'll be getting your announcement on what our topic will be for next week. Richard, it was so great to meet you, and we will have you back because I know you're just a wealth of interesting studies and ideas.
Appreciate that, Ariel.
Thank you, Sarah.
And by the way, I have to tell you, I really loved hearing you play piano and sing the other week. You were fabulous. That's the truth.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
We are saying goodnight now. Thank you for listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.
Okay, am I off?
The show's off, yes. I'm just doing the outro here.
Just want to say goodbye. And thanks. Is Sierra still there? Is Sierra there or is she gone?
Yeah, I think so.
Is this Ariel?
Hey, this is Ariel.
Hey, Ariel.
Sierra,
okay, well, I'm
going to
hang up. If Sierra's not there, just tell her I said thanks so much. I really enjoyed this.
Oh, it was our pleasure. We just thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Hello.
I loved it.
Yeah,
it was great. And I enjoyed talking with you
soon
as well.
Okay, Richard.
All right. Have a
thanks
great evening.
So
you take
you
care.
Too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.